Hi everyone, it's December 4th, 2023. This is I think it's the fourth class on Rav Zalman Bamberger. Thank you all for coming. Unfortunately, I was not here last week because my mother-in-law passed away, and I was down in Florida. I mentioned that some of you have traveled with us know my wife, so I'm happy to let you know this information. I know it's always strange. You meet people months or years later and you don't even realize that someone passed away. And actually, I'll just raise it only because a very interesting halachic issue came up. Something that, it's not actually uncommon, I don't think. And yet I looked in the standard halachic sources. I couldn't find the answer to this. I don't have the big art scroll book on Avelos, but I have other books. I looked online. There's a number of contemporary rabbis who discuss it, but no one cites any sources. And here was the question. My wife was an Onan on Friday. So do you make a bracha for Shabbos candles? Some rabbis were of the opinion that I called a number of rabbis also that yes, she does because it's connected to Shabbos. Others told me no, that she shouldn't. And one person told me that I should make the bracha. I asked Rabbi Lokesh, who's, I don't know if he's with us now, he's with us often, from Distinguished Rabbi in Detroit, and he asked a number of he thought she should, and he asked a number of the rabbis in Detroit, and I'll tell you what they said. Again, this is not so uncommon that you'd think that there'd be a standard view on this. Rav Asher Eisenberg, Posek in Detroit, says the bracha should be recited. Also, Rav Daniel Neustadt. But Rav Neustadt says only if the woman is lighting the standard time. If she's lighting before, I don't, what's the standard time? 18 minutes, any time from 18 minutes till sunset? I don't know what, let's say you're writing 20 minutes before. Is not that standard time? Let's say if Shabbos starts, if sunset is 8:15 and you make Shabbos at 7, I guess that's not standard time, but I don't know what the actual, number would be, for standard time. And, he says that Rav Shmuel Irons, that's Rav Savitsky's son-in-law, also says the woman should write a bracha. And from what I saw online, most people have that because the position because they assume it's connected to Shabbos. But then Rabbi Lokesh flipped the question. Let's say there is no wife and the man is an onan. Rav Eisenberg says no bracha. Rav Neustadt says yes bracha. And Rav Iron says if he's makabel Shabbos with the lighting, he makes the bracha. And generally, men who light candles are not Mekabel Shabbos then. So if he's not Mekabel Shabbos then, if he's Mekabel Shabbos later in Shul, he doesn't make the bracha. So we have a little bit of machlokes. But just here's an example of something that I don't think is so uncommon, and there doesn't seem to be absolute uniformity. I did a little reading. We spoke about the hospital last class. You know, this is one of the big issues. If the Orthodox remain part of the general community, then the hospital can be kosher, all the things that you'd expect to be in a, if it's a traditional run institution. And there was an old age home. It's a big community. They had all sorts of institutions. What I didn't know when I learned from this article is that the Auschwitz-Gemeinde, the Hirschian community, the IRG, Israelitische Religionsgesellschaft, they had a hospital also. It was called Rothschild's Hospital. It was established in 1850, and it continued to 1941 when the Nazis closed it. So that I did not know. One more thing before we begin, we have good stuff today. A couple of you wrote to me, you found it strange about Rabbi Bamberger in the dispute. And we're going to see the dispute. We saw some bitterness in the dispute. We'll see more bitterness. But how Rabbi Bamberger tries to shut down the dispute by saying that he's the authority and he can paskin this. And remember, Hirsch was saying to him that I'm the chacham of the community. I gave a psak. Who are you? And remember, there's no other rabbi then at the community. Official rabbi. It's not like there's two communities. There's the general community, but they don't have the rabbi. And then there's the separatist community. And for you, Bamberger, to come in and contradict me, that's not allowed. And Bamberger said that generally you're correct. However, that applies when the rabbis are of equal standing. But when one of the rabbis is greater, then he can. And so I understandably, it's a little bit surprising that a Gadol b'Yisrael is pulling rank this way. It reminds me perhaps the famous story of Rabbi Fesco Abramsky. I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but he was on in a trial. He was called as a witness, and the lawyer said something to him like, "Is it true, Rabbi Abramsky, that you're the greatest Talmudic authority in the United Kingdom?" And he replied, "Yes." And the judge said to him, "Rabbi Abramsky, isn't a rabbi supposed to be humble?" And he said, "Yes, indeed, but I'm under oath, so I have to tell the truth." If it's a dispute, and a lot ha hung on that dispute, and Rabbi Bamberger is being Hirsch is hassling Rabbi Bamberger, saying that his opinion is invalid because he's contradicting the local rabbi. I guess if the only way to save his opinion is to say that really we're not equal, that I'm regarded as greater than you, and your greatness, Hirsch, is not known to be in Talmud, Shas, and Poskim, and this is a fundamentally a halachic issue, and therefore I'm not bound by you. I have to say, and some of you are going to be happy with me saying this. Others are going to be very upset that I'd say this. And others are going to say that I just should have kept out of it, not put my head in there, when great, stick your head among the great mountains. But you pay me. You pay me to be here. Not that you pay me, but I'm here to give my opinion. And I have to say that in reading the halachic back and forth, I'm talking about the halachic here, not the general hashkafa. I have to say, with all due respect to Rabbi Bamberger, that I think Hirsch comes out on top. I mean, if you read the arguments back and forth, who am I to make this judgment? Okay, I'm a puny compared to these two giants. But in my opinion, in reading them, even though Bamberger is the Gadol HaDor in Germany, and he's the recognized, leader of Torah Judaism from in a rabbinic sense, halachic sense, I should say, I think Hirsch comes out on top in the argument. If you look at the argument back and forth, now it is true that, remember, Bamberger gives his decision. Hirsch comes out with his attack on Bamberger. Bamberger comes out with his defense of his decision and his attack on Hirsch. And then Hirsch comes out with a lengthy attack on Bamberger, and Bamberger doesn't reply. And his son says that he didn't want to create more dispute, more machlokes. He said his point, and that's that. Now, it could be that had Bamberger replied to Hirsch, then I would be saying, no, Bamberger comes out on top. We have a tendency to be led by the last position we see, or the last argument we see, and grant it more validity. Having said that, though, since Bamberger didn't reply, I don't have anything to go by. I'm just looking at what Hirsch says, what Bamberger's reply, and Hirsch's reply, and it seems, l'fi anius daiti, in my humble opinion, that Hirsch, from a halachic standpoint, leaving aside the hashkafa, which I'm much more sympathetic to Bamberger, just from a pure, if you're turning this into a pure halachic argument, it appears to me, at least, that Bamberger comes out on top, not all the arguments, but in many of them. I want to now introduce you to something that is not is halachic, but is also hashkafic, and it's an important point, also a great dispute between the two. As I'm calling this up, I just see, well, I'll get to the comments later, but I thank already, I'm going to write down Morty for what he says. Okay, what am I want to introduce yourself to? Well, Hirsch makes a big deal about the fact that the general community, he calls it the community of Minos, of the reformist community, the heretical community, namely the larger community, and therefore we can't have anything to do with them. Bamberger is going to make an interesting argument that let me introduce it to you now. Actually, before getting to this, I reminded I wanted to say one more thing that if you recall, I told you that Bamberger comes to Frankfurt and he meets with Rabbi Moshe Mainz, who's a business person, but he considers him a great Talmid Chacham, and Mainz convinces him that there's no need to separate. Since the Frankfurt community, the general community, is going to give the Orthodox everything they want. They can build a new shul, hire a rabbi, build a mikveh, everything they want. Moshe Mainz, I didn't mention this last class, he actually was a member of Hirsch's community. And like everyone, he was a member of Hirsch's community as well as the larger community. But there were Orthodox Jews who are not members of Hirsch's community. They were only a member of the general community. Mainz was a member of both communities. And nevertheless, he refuses to accept Hirsch, what the rabbi says. Moshe Mainz was older than Hirsch, was a Talmid Chacham in his own right, and he didn't feel bound by Hirsch. Now, it could be that the Mainz joined the Hirschian community just to show support for it. After all, this is a community of people who, at great financial sacrifice, are paying double taxation and are creating a community just controlled by the Orthodox. It could be that Rabbi Moshe Mainz simply thought that I was a great Kiddush Hashem, and he wanted to join and be part of it without giving up any of his autonomy. After all, he's just paying membership, and he could maybe go daven there. I don't know where he davened on Shabbos, but he was, in fact, he paid membership. I think we can also say, however, that he was not a Hirschian. Even there are many people in the separatist community who were not full Hirschians. Wait till I give you the numbers later. Hirsch had great successes in Germany. Torah Derech Eretz, enormous success. This dispute, he ends up, it's a big failure. And you know what I mean by failure? I'll read you later the numbers of his own community that went along with him. But before we get to that, I want to call your attention to something else. And that's the Rambam here in Hilchos Tshuva, because Hirsch and Bamberger have a dispute that revolves around this. It's the Rambam Sefer Mada, Hilchos Tshuva, Perek Gimel, Halacha Zayin. Many of you probably don't know what you're looking at here. What translation is this? We have the translation by Chabad of the Rambam. There's the Yale University, but this is the Yale University translation only has the English. The Chabad edition has Hebrew and English with a commentary, but this has not just the Hebrew and English, it has the Raivad's criticisms, also in English. This is a rare book, not very well known. I got it used books years ago. It's a translation by a Rabbi Simon Glazer, and he only did volume one of their Mishneh Torah. He wanted to complete the Hume. Who's Simon Glazer? Well, here's a picture of Simon Glazer. He, as it says in Wikipedia, an Orthodox rabbi who flourished at the turn of the 20th century from Kovno. He was rabbi in Montreal and New York City. I was thinking about him today because one of the places he was rabbi in was, well, he was in Toledo, Ohio, but he also was rabbi in Kansas City, and I'm going to Kansas City for the Shabbos. So I was thinking about him today. He was rabbi in Beis Medrash HaGadol in Harlem, also Bethel in Brooklyn. That's Bethel in Borough Park. And you can read all about him. He wrote a number of books, as you can see, including a book on the Jews of Iowa. And he was rabbi, in Montreal. He was known as chief rabbi of what they called the United Orthodox Congregations, or chief rabbi of Montreal. And he did a lot, but this created a huge machlokes between him and another rabbi. You can read all about it in Ira Robinson's book, Rabbis in Their Community, Studies in East European Orthodox Rabbin in Montreal. Great dispute between a Rabbi Hirsch Cohen and Rabbi Simon Glazer about Hashgacha, his big business. In fact, the Rabbi Glazer, Robinson discussed it, was attacked by some ruffians once because of had to do with the Hashgacha business. In addition to his peripatetic existence as a rabbi, and many of these rabbis were like it, incidentally, at the introduction to this in Hebrew, in the introduction to the translation of the Mishnah, he has a Hebrew autobiography, which I always love these autobiographies. Many rabbis would write used to write these autobiographies, and they all say the same thing, or many of them do, that when I was young, I was an Eloi, and there was no one who could teach me, so I had to go to this rabbi, that rabbi. It's interesting. Okay, so why am I what am I interested in Rabbi Glazer's translation? It's this halacha. So before we see how this is used by Bamberger, let's see what the Rambam says. Halacha Zayin. It's a famous halacha. Chamisha hein hanikraim minim. There are five who are called minim. Glazer translates this as atheists. That's not what a min is. Doesn't mean atheist. It could mean an atheist, but it doesn't mean atheist. It means a heretic. When we have in Shmoneh Esrei Birkas Haminim, it doesn't mean blessing against the atheists. Yeah, so I mean that's just a mistake. But the rest of the translation is okay. Ha'omer she'ein sham en lola, ve'ein lola manhig va'omer. So the first one is who says there is no God and the world has no ruler. By the way, this is the most mistranslated word in Hebrew. Aleph, Lev, Vav, Hey. I'm convinced of this. And you can hear all the people mistranslate it because we say it in Hallel. You say it in Yomim Noraim, but Hallel, you say it out loud often. In whether you sing it in Malacha Hayam or whether they just recite it, you have people often say Aloha. You know, there's a dagesh in the hey, so they like to stress it. But first of all, the accent is on the lamed, not on the hey. And it's Eloah. So the Masoretes give two ways of pronouncing it. It's either Eloah or Eloah with a W. This is what's called a patach genuva. Patach is not feminine, but it's tenuat, patach genuva. It's called a furtive patach. It's no different than what we have Noach. We've spoken about this in the past. You don't say Nocha, Noah. It's Noah, Noach. That is the syllable goes before the last letter. Okay, that's the first heretics. Understand. What's the second heretic? Omer Sheishamanhig. You say that there is a ruler. This word sham here doesn't mean place. It's just an Arabic type of, it's bringing over to Hebrew the Arabic word. It doesn't really have a translation. It's like is. If you look at Ibn Tibbon's introduction to his translation or to the Mor Nevuchim, he explains that word sham. Amazing how many people try to explain what that word sham is. There is an omnipotent force, a ruler, whatever. But there's more than one God. So those are the first two heresies. The third heresy is the one we're interested in. Ha'omer she'yesham ribon echad, you acknowledge that there's one God, aval shehu guf uval tmunah, but you say that he has a physical form. You're a heretic. And for the Rambam, this is obvious. By definition, a being that has physicality is subject to corruption. It, by definition, cannot be perfect because if you have a body, you're in this place, you're not in that place. You can't be omnipotent because you're limited by your physicality. As I said, there's decay. So the Rambam, by definition, philosophically, God cannot have a physical form. So what does the Ravid say on this? If you're interested in more details about this, you can open up my book, Limits of Orthodox Theology, Chapter 3, because this is also the Rambam's third principle of the Mishnah Torah, of the 13 principles. So what does the Ravid say? If you say that their God is one, but he's physical form, Amar Avraham, the Ravid's name is Abraham. V'lama karo lazem min. Why does the Rambam call such a person a min? V'chama gedolim v'tovim mimenu halchu bazo machshava. There are people greater than the Rambam who followed this belief, namely that God had a physical form. Why they think this? L'fi ma sh'ra'u b'mikros, based on what they saw in the scriptures. Because after all, it says in Tanakh that God walks through the garden. God has an outstretched arm. The Yoser Mimasha Hagados and more based on what they saw in the Agadah, which confused people. God puts on tefillin, things like that. Now, the Raiva doesn't think this is correct. God does not have a physical form. But he says there are people who think that, great people. He knew that the Rambam was great. He's saying even people greater than the Rambam. Again, I'm not going to get into this now. Take a look at Limits of Orthodoxology to see who he was speaking about and where these people would get these ideas. But what the Raivat says that's important for us is that these people are not heretics. Why are they not heretics? Because it was an honest error. They weren't rebelling against Judaism. They read the Torah and Navi, and they read Gemara, and they mistakenly assume that these things should be taken literally when they're not. And therefore, how can you call them heretics? They don't know any better. Now, it's not clear whether the Raivad thought this was a heresy, to believe God as a physical form. It could be he didn't. But later figures did agree with the Rambam that this is heresy, and they accept the Raivad's position. That someone who doesn't know any better is not to be regarded as a heretic. And this then creates a great dispute that lasts from the Rambam's day to the present. The sugya, you can call it kafira b'shogeg. What about an unwitting heretic? A heretic, someone who believes in a heresy but doesn't know any better. For the Rambam, and this ties into his naturalistic understanding of what the world to come is, there's no such thing as an unwitting heretic does not exempt you. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik famously formulated it as, Reb Chaim Brisker I'm talking about, is a nebuchadnezzar is oichan apikores. If you're a nebuchadnezzar, if you don't know any better, you're still a heretic. But the Raivad, and well, again, assuming the Raivad sees it as heresy, Reb Yosef Albo quotes the Raivad, adopts this position, he sees it as heresy. And you can go from Reb Yosef Albo to the Radbaz down to the present day. Rav Kook, Rav Aaron Sol, I think Rav Aaron Sol, actually, I don't know about Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Rav Kook definitely says it. Rav Moshe Sternbach, many, many others. Namely, someone who believes heresy, but believes it because they don't know any better. They were raised this way, or it's an honest mistake. They are not to be regarded as heretics. So a kofer b'shogeg, one who's an unwitting heretic, is not to be regarded as a heretic. That is, the belief is heretical, but he is not a heretic. Now, this opens up all sorts of options, which we'll see presently, because what about the Reformed Jew? Are all Reformed Jews to be regarded as heretics and rejectors? Maybe they don't know any better. And this is why this passage is important for us, because the Rabbi Bamberger picks up on this. In the collected writings on page 236, he first quotes Hirsch. Hirsch, in issuing his psak, that it was forbidden to remain in a community that the leadership of this community were reformers. What does Hirsch say? As a matter of principle, Hirsch says, how can anyone remain in such a community that, quote, as a matter of principle, has stricken from its prayer book every reference to the person of Mashiach, to the Kibbutz Galiot, to the bringing together of the exiles, to the restoration of the Beis Hamikdash, to the Seder Avoda, past and future, that has eliminated Eretz Ubris and Malchus Beis David from Birkas Hamazon? What name do you give to such a system whose pulpit and school preach that the mitzvos are outdated? Well, what does Hirsch say? He agrees. He says, I would call such a community the most blatant minus and apikorsis. And he says a community that professes such a belief system in its liturgy is in the category of minos and apikorsos, and every Jew must regard such a system as totally incompatible with traditional Judaism. But he says, but Bamberger goes further and says, however, this system does not reach the true culmination of its contrast to Torah if it springs from ignorance. were from a faulty and erroneous interpretation of Torah, in which case it can't be considered kfirah. So Bamberger says that when dealing with the non-Orthodox, with the reformers, we have to ask, are they reformers because they are lahachis? They are knowledgeable. They're people like Geiger, let's say, who know what the Torah says, and they're choosing to reject it. Or are we dealing with people who don't know any better? And therefore, yes, their belief system, their ideology is minos, he says, apikorsos. But the people themselves will not have that status, and therefore, we are not going to be forbidden from joining together with them in the name of the greater good. He goes further, and he says that this distinction, Bamberger says, between unwitting heretics, let's say, and not knowing heretics, he says this is fully confirmed. All you have to do is look in the Rambam. And yes, the Rambam says his position, but the Raivad, he says, most categorically opposes the use of this epithet, namely a heretic, for such an individual, the individual who doesn't know any better. He says the Raivad declares that if this error has arisen from a misinterpretation, then he can't be labeled as min. And he says from this, it's clear that if someone commits a transgression against an indisputable principle of the Torah, but does so not because he denies the binding authority of that principle, but because he doesn't understand it, you can't describe him as a heretic. Well, and we're going to see. So then, well, why would this apply to the Jews of Frankfurt? We're going to see why Bamberger will apply it to them in a second. He says, where the cause is not lack of understanding, but wanton denial, lahachis, then we're dealing with, he says, a mesisumediach, someone who is a chote omachti atarabi, one who knowingly is rejecting the proper ideas and bringing other people into their net. But is that what we're focused on here? So Bamberger says no. He says, how do you know, he says, quote, whether a reformed community and its trustees belong to the first category, namely that of complete heretics, like Hirsch said, or the second category that they don't know any better. And what's the answer? He says it's obvious. That's what he says. He says it's very clear. Listen to this. If a community would be in a position, financially and otherwise, to provide for the needs of its Orthodox members and to establish and maintain the institutions indispensable to any pious Jew, but it fails to do so, then he says that such a reformed community shows that they are not established on any proper foundation. They don't just accept a position that deviates from orthodoxy, but they are denying the foundations of the Torah. Because if this were not true, he says they would at least have a sense of fairness. And maybe they're not following traditional understandings of Torah and mitzvot, but they'll at least allow the Orthodox to do that and fund it. Therefore, when you have such a community would be regarded, you have to classify them as lahachis and as mesis mediach. However, is that the case in Frankfurt? And he says, actually, before he goes into that, he says, I agree with you, Hirsch, on all this. In fact, he cites a letter he wrote in which he sent to individuals in Frankfurt. And he said that it's categorically forbidden for Torah Jews to participate in any manner in the operation and maintenance of a hospital run by a Reformed community, even if one member of the Orthodox community was elected to the board of the Reformed community. So Bamberger goes so far as to say that if the community we're speaking about in Frankfurt is a real reformist community, okay, and there's a hospital in the community, an Orthodox Jew would not even be permitted to be on the board of the Reform community in connection with that institution. That is, you couldn't even be on the board of the hospital as long as the hospital is under the control of the reformers. He says that even the addition of a member of the Religions Gesellschaft to the board of the hospital cannot change anything. He says the board, furthermore, he says you cannot have a board member at all on anything dealing with religious issues that is out of a lower standard than the rabbis. In other words, in a community, you cannot have the board member of a shul who's not a Shomer Shabbos. He says the board members of the community must meet the same standards of religious conduct as the members of a rabbinical council. That's something that look at your typical Orthodox shul outside the New York area. They all have board members who are Mechalel Shabbos, or I should say many of them do. Look at schools. I can tell you, that major schools, Jewish high schools and elementary schools, have members who are not Shomrei Shabbos, but they give a lot of money and they want to support the institution. I've never heard anyone say that they can't, in our communities, modern Orthodox, that they can't be members of the board. It was well known that in separatist communities, for example, in Hungary, Hirshian community also, if you're not a Shomer Shabbos, you couldn't be on the board. But that's not the way we do things in America. I don't know who was on the board of Maimonides, but I'm assuming when the Rav was alive, there were plenty of people who were not Shomer Shabbos on the board. They didn't make decisions. They were just there to raise money. And if they want to contribute, it's, but so we see that Bamberger is a Kanai, you could say. He's an extremist on these matters, more extreme than other people were. Absolutely. So that if you have what he regards as a reform community, it cannot be recognized by Orthodox Jews at all. However, let's now look what he says though about on page 240. No, not 240. He says at page 241 and 242. He says as follows. If you're looking at the Frankfurt community, the Frankfurt general community, which has agreed. Now, why they decided to agree to that, or Hirsch would say maybe that's relevant, but Bamberger is not concerned. The fact is they did agree. I mean, you could say the only reason they agreed is because they didn't want to lose the tax money, but the fact is they agreed. What did they agree to? To build an Orthodox synagogue. That's the synagogue that if you go to Frankfurt today, right next to the museum and right next to the, it was called the Bornplatz. Right next to where the cemetery is, where all the Gedolei Yisrael are buried. If you go there on the ground, you could see they have a like a drawing of where it was. You see how big, but because it was destroyed in Kristallnacht. They not only build a shul, hire a rabbi, a real rabbi, a Talmud Chacham. They would hire a Mordechai Horovitz, Marcus Horovitz. We'll speak more about him later. Recognized great Talmudic scholar, Talmud Muvak of Israel Hildesheimer. He's known as the Matei Levi. They offered to build the mikveh. They offered to have no, they because remember they closed the mikveh and they put it out in one of the Jews would have to go to the suburbs. They offered that they would allow the Orthodox to have complete autonomy. That is, the board members of the general community would have no influence whatsoever, not in choosing the rabbi, not in how the shul is run, not in how the school, anything, any Orthodox institution would be completely run by the Orthodox community. The only connection would be that the tax money would go to the community and then it would go back, of course, to the Orthodox community and would be used to support institutions that they all use, such as the hospital of the Old Age Home. And the hospital in the Old Age Home would be under Orthodox control in terms of religious issues like kashrus. There also would be a Beis Din that would be of the general community. I'll talk more about who was on that based in later classes. Important people. Under these circumstances, Bamberger says that since we see the leadership of the community willing to give the Orthodox everything they want, we cannot regard them as out of the fold. We have to regard them as sinners, as people who are misguided, but not heretics of the sort that we can't have anything to do with. He says, the board of the community is now prepared to provide for the needs of the non-seceding Orthodox members by setting up for them with communal funds the religious institutions they require. At the same time, said members will not have to make any financial contributions towards facilities for reform, worship, and education. See, the reform are the majority. So it's not a problem. The Orthodox, all their taxes are going back to their institutions. It would have been a problem If let's say 70% of the community is Orthodox and 30% is Reformed, then the Orthodox are giving money that's going to the Reformed. But that wasn't the situation. He says, we see from this that the board recognizes the legitimacy of the religious requirements of the Orthodox and is ready to implement them. In other words, the board has no wish to deny, vis-a-vis the Orthodox, the strict and sacred binding authority of the Torah. He goes on to say, not only does it not seek to impede their observance of Torah, on the contrary, although they profess reform, and that's a terrible thing, nevertheless, when it comes to the Orthodox, they wish to entrust the safeguarding and protection of these religious concerns entirely to the Orthodox. Now, if I'm Hirsch here, I'm sitting here rolling my eyes because this is the same community that 5 years before was doing everything in its power to prevent the Orthodox from having an Orthodox lifestyle. They were oppressing them. I use the word oppressing. I guess they were oppressing them, weren't giving them what they want. That's what the word oppressing means. Not the woke oppression that you hear about all the time. Everything's an different oppression. But they were not treating the Orthodox fairly. They were prejudiced against them. So all of a sudden now, when the Orthodox are going to succeed because the law was passed, now the Reform are willing to give them everything they want. You're going to, how does that change who they are? They're the same people. They're just making a different decision on the basis of financial considerations. If I'm Hirsch, I'm sitting there thinking, they're the same apikoresim, that's the same kfira, and it's not that out of the goodness of their heart. They're giving us the Orthodox everything they want. Nevertheless, Bamberger, he writes, at the end of the day, you have to look at their actions. Whether Bamberger thought that they were chozer b'tshuva due to the financial pressures, or whether, as far as he's concerned, it doesn't matter. Dvarim shebelev v'varim, we say. What you think in your heart doesn't matter. The fact is, they're giving the Orthodox everything the Orthodox want, and therefore we cannot regard them anymore as people interested in uprooting Torah Judaism. They do not practice Torah Judaism. In their own communities, they have uprooted it, but being that they're willing, not just willing, but going to the effort to give the Orthodox everything they want so that they can have Torah Judaism, we cannot regard them anymore as out of the fold. We can't regard them as heretics. Yes, they believe heresy, obviously, but they can't be regarded as heretics. Of course, we would call them heretics. That's what a heretic is, when it believes heresy. But from the standpoint of the way the Rambam regards it, a heretic is one who you can have nothing to do with. You could push him in a pit if you, in the olden days. I mean, all that, he's no longer in the community. Completely, we have no connection to them whatsoever. And Bamberger says, since they're willing to do all this for the Orthodox, we cannot treat them this way. That's an amazing thing. So, and the final thing he says is this community, the general community, has agreed to hire a Moritz Tzedek, a rabbi, and this will be, Bamberger says, one who will be able to issue directives for all religious matters. And there will be a board of trustees that is completely religious. And if you don't get If this, you don't have guarantees for this, then my ruling doesn't stand. So that's his position. It's something we can appreciate, I think. It's something we can understand. Most of our communities function this way. If you're in the modern Orthodox world, that is, the rabbis are involved in federations and have various connections to the non-Orthodox. And Bamberger says that as long as they're not actively trying to undermine Torah Judaism, and all the more so, they're even helping Torah Judaism. We don't need to separate from them. There's other things he says that are relevant. So, for example, on page 248, he says that when you're dealing with such a situation, when the non-Orthodox are not interested in uprooting Torah Judaism, by us being connected to them, there's advantages. Why? He says, although we reject and detest the belief system of reform, this should not break the ties of personal friendship that bind us. We cherish the hope that sooner or later that the non-Orthodox will come to realize the truth, as we do. So if the reformers were actively trying to uproot Torah Judaism, we couldn't have anything to do with them. No chance for Kiruv. However, as long as they're not actively doing that, we can remain in the same community and we can have a good influence on them. Let me point out some other things that Bamberger says, because he responds to Hirsch. On page 245, he responds to Hirsch saying as follows. Hirsch says that according to Halakha, we must keep a greater distance from Minos and Apikorsos than even from Avodah Zarah. That is, from heresy, than from, we have to keep further from, than from idolatry. Do you know that in Hirsch's school in Frankfurt, they would never hire non-Orthodox Jews to teach? They would hire religious Jews and Christians. Hirsch said that if you hire a non-religious Jew to teach a class, the children, of course, it's not like today in America where they demean teachers. In those days, the teacher you gave kavod to, you looked up to. If you have a non-Orthodox teacher, the students are going to look to this teacher, and he'll be a there'll be a, there'll, you'll be a, an element of admiration. You admire the teacher, a role model. Hirsch said you cannot have a non-Orthodox Jew teaching in a school because the teacher will be a role model. And what's the role model? That you could be a dignified person, a good person, and not be a Shomer Shabbos, not eat kosher. So you can't have that. In America, of course, well, I shouldn't say that. These are private schools. You can do what you want. But never, it's unimaginable that our high schools, our day schools, would ever say that we're not going to hire non-religious Jews. We have the rights. We're private schools. We could do that. Years ago, I bet they wouldn't hire people who intermarried, because that would have been out of the fold. Today, we're not concerned with that. We don't look who's intermarried, who's not. It's not a concern of ours. But Hirsch wouldn't. So Hirsch would hire Christians to teach. Because, like we just said, Minos and Apikorsos, we have to keep further from it than Avodah Zarah. He says we have to keep further away from contact with Jewish elements that oppose Jewish law than we do from paganism. And he brings proof. What's the proof? The Gemara says that in order to save your life, you're allowed to go into a take shelter in a house of Avodah Zarah, but not in a house of Minim. And he quotes another Gemara in Avodah Zarah. Rav Yishmael says that someone should die rather than be treated by a min, but not a problem if a worshiper of a pagan is going to treat you, not a problem. And Hirsch goes on and explains that Minos is different because it'll bring you towards it. It can, it's enticing for you. And it's more likely to lead a Jew astray than outright idolatry. Consequently, it's clear beyond question that anything forbidden to us with regard to Avodah Zarah is even more emphatically forbidden when it comes to Minos. Okay, so what is, so here he's saying that, obviously, we can't be together with the Christians in one community. So certainly, we can't be together with the non-Orthodox, the heretics, and even more so. Even if you tell me that maybe in certain things you could be with the Christians, it's easier to be with the Christians than it is with the heretics, because by being with them, by sitting with them, by being involved with them, we can be negatively influenced to be led in the direction of reform. So, what does Bamberger say to this? It appears to be good sources. He says, I'm only going to tell you what Bamberger says. Then Hirsch replies to him. Bamberger says to him, when you said this, Rabbi Hirsch, you must have followed your memory. You didn't look up the sources, because had you looked up the sources, you never could have said this. And he cites, well, why does he say that? Because Bamberger says to him, the Gemara is speaking about Minim. Who are Minim? Minim are Jews who became pagans. Jews who completely rejected the Judaism for idolatry. He says, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about Jews who have been raised, he says, and educated by his parents in his erroneous beliefs. He says, how can you compare the Reformed Jews that were with in Frankfurt, who don't know any better, and with people who are actually pagans, people who had who knew the true faith, but had denied and abandoned it. You have to distinguish between the two. And he says also Rabbi Shmuel, the same case with Rabbi Shmuel. He says, you need to distinguish between pagans, people opposed in principle to Jewish law, as opposed to people who just don't follow the Jewish law. But their attitude is, if we don't follow it, it's not good for me. If you want to follow it, you can follow it. Minim and Apikorsim want to spread their heresy. That's not the case with the people we're dealing with in Frankfurt. Whether that's the Metsios, as we say, or not, I think very much that Hirsch would disagree with him. In fact, later in Hirsch's response, he says, "Bamberger, you come to town. How can you make decisions based upon speaking to someone? If you're not in the city, you don't see what's really going on here." And I mean, that's something he could say about this as well. He goes on to say, okay, so he continues saying the same thing. And then finally, towards the end, he says, Bamberger says there's three types of Jews in Frankfurt. There's the strictly Orthodox, who are a member of Hirsch's community. Then there are the reformers. And then there are those who have not joined Hirsch's community, nor the Reform. These are just people who continue going to the Orthodox synagogue that exists in Frankfurt and are sort of on the fence because many of, remember, the real Orthodox in Frankfurt joined Hirsch's community. The problem was for Hirsch is that when they were given the opportunity to withdraw from the general community, they refused to because they felt ties of Klal Yisrael, all sorts of reasons. Bamberger says, Hirsch, you're forgetting about this middle group. Namely, the group of basically Torah observant Jews who are not so machped, who haven't joined your community, but they want religious life. They want a Torah life, but they're not the most strict. He says, but are we supposed to abandon these people? Are we not supposed to give them institutions? They're not joining your community, Hirsch. Don't they need a mikveh? I don't understand. I mean, they don't want, they're not a member of your community. For whatever reason, they don't want to go to your community. Maybe they feel they have to join it, they can't afford it, they don't want it, whatever it is. They don't want to go to your shul. Shouldn't they have the right to have a shul? If we don't give them a shul, maybe they'll start attending the Reform Synagogue. Remember, Reform synagogues, they have an organ, but they didn't have mixed seating. You can see how people in the middle could be led astray. He says that we have a responsibility for these people as well. Religious law does not forbid us to use our financial means to help establish institutions also for these people. He says that we're not obligated to. He says there's no obligation to open up another shul or another mikveh for these people because your community here has it. So technically, we're not obligated to, but there's no prohibition. And if we have the money, why not do it? And he concludes by saying that what we've seen already, that the session law is a great blessing for Orthodox Jews. It allows Jews the opportunity to secede when necessary. It also, as we know, forces the general community to give compromises. He says that I do not doubt for a minute that your community will continue to exist and carry on. And I do not believe that people who refuse to secede will negatively affect your community. And then he says something. Hirsch has attacked him. We're going to see next class why Hirsch attacked him. Yaakov Katz has an interesting approach to this, but Hirsch, in his response, his initial response to Bamberger, his first letter, says that, well, this is not surprising because we know that you, Rabbi Bamberger, don't accept Torah Derech Eretz. You don't agree with our philosophy, so of course you're going to come out against us. What does Bamberger say to this? He says, it is true. He says that I am not in, well, actually, let me read the words. He says, you are mistaken when you say that I do not support Torah Derech Eretz. He says, I'm in favor of Torah Derech Eretz, but I don't want it to be misinterpreted. What he's saying is that you, Rabbi Hirsch, have misinterpreted it. To your extreme infatuation, I guess he would say, with Western civilization, Derech Eretz. What Bamberger says, he says, I want rabbis to acquire a scientific secular education. Absolutely. We know that Bamberger himself acquired a secular education. We're not dealing with some Polish Hasidic rabbi or some rabbi in Hungary who put a ban on secular education. No, yes, I believe in secular education, he says. However, this cannot happen at the expense of Torah study. That's a dig, of course, as to what's going on in Frankfurt. He says, The latter must be safeguarded in its full vigor against any abridgment or detraction. But he says, yes, I want teachers of religion to know about secular studies, and that this all has to be taught. He says that he then cites a passage from the recent report of his teacher seminary, where he says that by studying general sciences, this doesn't interfere with any Torah matters. On the contrary, if properly understood, it's in beautiful harmony with the latter. That is, Torah and secular and science, they go together. So it's a difference in degree, perhaps, that Hirsch is, and I don't know if Bomberger was into the humanities. You know, it could be that he's more interested in science. I've never seen any place where that would imply that Bomberger thinks that, you know, studying Schiller or Goethe, that you know, helps form the religious personality. So this is the response of Bomberger, a strong defense of his position, a novel view that the reform that we are dealing with here, they themselves, although they are misguided and preaching heresy, they themselves are not in the category of heresy of the sort that we need to, of heretics that we need to separate ourselves totally from. And as long as they give the Orthodox community everything the Orthodox community wants, then we could get along with them, and we could do things that benefit all of us. Now, Rav Bomberger's son, Rav Simcha Bomberger, has a volume of Tshuvos, Zecher Simcha. And in number 230, he continues with this and defends his father's position and goes into detail. And he says right at the beginning of it, he says, he stresses this point, that if we're members of the community, that ulai al yadei kein tigbor yad yirei shamayim haba, that maybe the Orthodox will become stronger. V'tikbatel ha-reform b'chola. V'godol koach ha-shalom, b'ofen hazeh, yotem l'idchot b'shtei adayim l'chadoma. He says that if we belong to the general community, then maybe we're going to have an influence, and maybe we can triumph over reform. And peace in such matters is always very important, and it's better to have peace than to push them away b'shtei adayim. He's alluding to the story with Jesus, where the problem was, the rabbis say the problem was that Jesus, they didn't just push him away with one hand, they pushed him away with both hands. When you're dealing with people who have incorrect beliefs, you're not supposed to push them away with both hands. Yes, you can push them away with one hand, meaning talk about how the belief is incorrect, but don't push them away with two hands, because then you're just losing them forever. So Rav Zecher Simcha says, by being part of the community and by not pushing them away, by being together with them in one community in Shalom, we still have the one hand that we can bring them close, and we can be makariv them. We can accept their children into our schools. We can try to make sure that all joint events are done with a Torah flavor to them, to slowly to try to bring Yiddishkeit to them. And that's a position, again, and I think many of us are well aware of, because the communities we're in adopt that position as well. Much to Hirsch's great disappointment, you know, despite the fact that, as I said, I think if you read Hirsch's response to Bamberger, it really, he makes very good points, but at the end of the day, though, it's really not important from the standpoint of the Balabatim who has the better argument, or if an argument is strong or weak. When a great Torah sage like Rabbi Bomberger says that you don't need to separate, that's the halacha for most people. It's like us. If Rav Moshe Feinstein or Vlad Yosef would come out with a psak, maybe we'd read the psak and we'd say it's not so convincing in certain areas. But that doesn't take away from the fact that we can rely on it, because these are the Gedolei Yisrael. And who are we? We're not in their league. So, yes, we can look at it and maybe say not everything's so convincing, but by virtue of their office, as it were, they have the authority. So the fact that the Gadol Hador in Germany, Rabbi Bomberger, said that you don't need to separate under these conditions, most people are not going to be reading the back and forth between Hirsch and Bomberger. The Hirschians continue to say, read the writing, read the arguments back and forth, and tell me if you think that Rav Bomberger's position get is the better one, is the more correct one. But that's not what people are going to do. And they don't have to do that. A regular Baal Bas doesn't need to evaluate these arguments. He can look at the fact that Rabbi Bamberger held his position. And that's why Hirshian, although Torim Derech Eretz became widely adopted throughout Germany, the Austrian philosophy was never more than, in small segments of the population, it became accepted in most places, including in places like Frankfurt and Berlin, where you had a separatist community. Most Orthodox Jews were not members of it, and even the more, and if they were members, they didn't. I should say most Orthodox Jews were members of the larger community. This includes even most Orthodox Jews who are a member of Hirsch's own community. Including the Rothschild family, the big backers of it. Now, one of the reasons for this is that people did not, people had a connection, first of all, to the community, the larger community. They felt a sense of responsibility. Maybe we don't have that today because we're in America, we don't have kehillos. But if you've been living in Frankfurt, your family's been living there for hundreds of years, the idea that you're going to leave the community, they had a great sense of connection, responsibility, kehillah kedosha. Here said, no, we're the kehillah kedosha. That's not the Kiel Kadosha. Once the Reform took over, it's no longer the Kiel Kadosha, the community. We're the Kiel Kadosha. But that's not how the people saw it, because it's that is the community. That is the historic community, even though it was taken over by the Reform. But now it's not run by the Reform. Now it's only run by, partly run by the Reform, because we have our own Orthodox community, in the original community. And the cemetery. I don't know why people were so attached to the cemetery. It's not the classic cemetery. They had built a new cemetery like a generation before that. So it's not like my Zaidi, my Alta Zaidi, and they're all buried in this cemetery, and I want to be buried there. The new Frankfurt cemetery, maybe your parents were there, but it doesn't go back many generations. That's the original cemetery where the Gedol Yisrael, the Bnei Yeshua, the Maror Shif are buried. That's the cemetery. The Chasam Sofer's mother is there. You can go visit that. It's a big tourist attraction when you go to Frankfurt. But what all I can say is they were connected to the cemetery. If you go to the cemetery today, you see during World War II a bomb fell on it, and it broke the wall because the Hirshians had to open up their own cemetery. So you had two cemeteries right next to each other with a wall in the middle. Now the wall, I can't say. That's what I was told when I was there, that a bomb landed on it. I don't know if the bomb broke the whole thing down, so it opened up, whatever they maybe it's a good story if it did, but if you go there today, you see that they opened it up, and you can walk from one to the other as it should be. And I was told that a bomb landed on, I guess it's symbolic that the bomb landed on the wall, even if it didn't break it open completely. It showed that maybe in today's day and age, we shouldn't have these separate, that at least in death we should all be together. And by the way, Hirsch did not oppose this. Hirsch never said, came out with a prohibition of being buried in the regular cemetery. The Orthodox and have a separate, I mean, I could see why he should have said this, but as far as I know, he never said that. In fact, he never said that the Orthodox in the communal cemetery, that it's a prohibition for them to be buried there. If they have their own section of the cemetery, he said that's not a problem. He said that the reason we're not being buried there is because the community won't allow us to be buried there because we don't pay taxes. Now that I think of it, though, I don't know why Hirsch didn't think it was a problem. Why? And he, it's a cemetery that belongs to the community. The community has reformers in it, so why should we be buried in such a cemetery? He obviously made a distinction between living with these people and being part of institutions that they have a say in and being buried there. It would seem to me that he should have said, let's have our own cemetery, but he didn't. And as for the people who said he only built the cemetery when he had to. And as for the people who said, we want to be buried in this cemetery, and therefore we can't leave the Gemeinde, the general community, Hirsch could not understand this at all. He said, you're worried about where you're going to be buried? And you're sinning by being in this community. Every day you're sinning, and we'll make our own cemetery. I'll give you next class. I see it's already time. I will give you the actual numbers of who remained in Hirsch's community, sorry, and who remained in the general community and who seceded and was only a member of Hirsch's community. And you'll see what I mean when I say he was a great failure for Hirsch, a failure that Hirsch realized. And this failure continued until the end of the Frankfurt community. Well, this had all sorts of implications because if you know the history of it, we'll talk more about it maybe. It created a huge machlokas in the Frankfurt community itself over who would succeed, not Hirsch, but Hirsch's son-in-law, who would be the successor to them, because many of the people thought that the Hirschian family had become, even though Hirsch is the great rabbi of this community, he had become, the family had become too extreme on this matter. And we'll talk more about that. We'll deal with, I think you're probably interested, so I'll talk more about what happens in the two Frankfurt communities, the extremism. Do you know that the Hirschians put a cheirem on the Brunnenplatz synagogue? You could not enter it, but very few people followed it. But that was the official position. Hirsch refused to greet Rabbi Marcus Mordechai Horowitz when he was appointed the rabbi there, and he and his son-in-law refused to be in the same room, if they could help it, with Rabbi Mordechai Marcus Halevi Horowitz. So it was very, very bitter. But oh, and I will tell you next class as well that for the irony here is because for all the extremism of Hirsch in Frankfurt, when it came to Hungary, Hirsch refused to go along with the separatism in Hungary. And I'll explain that. Let me make a note of that to tell you next class. We'll have to talk about Hungary too, because after we finish with this, we got to go with Hungary because the Maharam Shik has a tshuva opposing Bamberger. So we need to understand what was going on in Hungary. And then, of course, we'll take it to America as well. Thank you, Morty, for saying that Rabbi Mari Salam's book says not to, you're saying he says, I have the book upstairs. I didn't look at it actually, that the woman does not make a bracha when she's an onan. Okay, I have to check that out. I did not know. I should have checked. I looked in other books. I didn't look in that. Paul says that the Abramsky anecdote is in Bernard Homa's A Fortress in Anglo-Jewry, History of the Machzike Hadass, the East End Synagogue. Yes, thank you very much. I was thinking about that book today because I'm always ahead of where we're going to be. So after we finish with Bamberger, need probably four more classes with him, I would think. Then I'm going to do the Musar dispute. And then I'm going to do Rabbi Molliver, founder of religious Zionism, or one of the founders of religious Zionism. And he was involved in the great dispute over between the Machzike Hadass and the chief rabbinate. So I was thinking about that book today. Someone texts me regarding Minos Napikorsas. I don't know what the relevance is that when the famous story, which Radoitzer Hoffman mentions in his Tshuvos, I discussed it in Changing the Immutable, when he came to visit Hirsch, that he told him that not to leave his hat on because the non-Jews would see this, that is to be bareheaded. Non-Jews would see this and see it as something, it was disrespect. Now you say yarmulke was fine. The implication of the tshuva is no yarmulke. That's to go bareheaded when he went to see him. That's the whole tshuva. The tshuva is discussing about how in the schools, how in the Hirschian school, they did not cover their heads at all for the secular subjects. So the tshuva there is about taking off your hat, any covering. That's just about that. Hirsch didn't want the non-Jewish teachers to think that Dovid Hoffman was disrespecting him. And then someone privately texts me. He says it's scary is that the only the German Ashkenazic Jews are aware of and learn of Bamberger. Most yeshiva bachurim have no idea of who he was and what he wrote. Well, it could be, I think, you mentioned two books, Maaseh Shamayim and Mor haZvachim. It could be that these are more practical halachic works. And yeshivas, they're not yeshivas, they know who Rav Yaakov Ettlinger was, who lives the same time as Bamberger, because he wrote Chidushim on Shas. And everyone learns the Aruch HaNer, the Kuri Yaakov. Rabbi Bamberger was focused on practical halacha rather than writing Chidushim on Shas. And that is probably the reason why they didn't know him. But you say it's scary, they don't know him. The people in the yeshiva world don't know most of the Litvish Gedolim. They don't know most of the Polish Gedolim. The yeshiva world has a very small canon of what Sfarim have made it in, and based on that, what Gedolim have made it in. Yes, they know certain big figures from the 19th century, but you can go down the list of all the lots of Gedolim that they don't know about them either. So that's not surprising. Thank you, Ricky. David says that Shmir Shabbos Kochasa says that one lights Shabbos Yom Tov candles with a bracha, that is an Onan lights it with the bracha. Okay, so we see we have disputes here. MJ Franco says, Semi Yafet, eyewitness to the whole thing, claimed in 1930 talk that the ones who did secede were all either dependent on the Hirsch or on the IRG Shul in some way. Yes, he wrote an article, Recollections. He was quoting from his, actually, there's two articles. It's his article and Isaac Heinemann. Itzhak Heinemann wrote an article in which he recorded oral traditions from his father. Listen, there was the dispute continued, and we're going to get to Rav Chaim Ozer, because then the dispute comes back in the early part of the 20th century, and the Hirshians try to get Rav Chaim Ozer to come on their side. Well, I shouldn't say that. I know it's Hirshians, as I recall. There are great disputes in the Hirshian community in Frankfurt itself. If we have time at the end, I could speak about some of this. So you have people who know the history as well. But the whole dispute over who would succeed Rabbi Breuer, the son-in-law of Hirsch, when he passes away, the question is who's going to succeed him? The family, the Hirshian family, wanted it to be the son, Rafael Breuer, and keep it in the family. But the community did not want, and this led to bitter arguments and disputes in the community, a whole split in the community. You had one of the Dayanim came out with a public statement, but Jacob Rosenheim, Moreno Yaakov Rosenheim, led the forces in opposition to the Breuer family. And yet they're part of the community. So a terrible break. They would bring in a rabbi from Hungary. Ironically, just this Shabbos, his great grandson was davening with me in my shul. He introduced himself to me. His name was Yosef Yonah Har Yonah Yosef Yonah 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 Harvitz Yonah Yosef, I forget now, the Yonsdorfer Rav. And Yaakov Katz recollects what happened. They needed a Hungarian. You can't get a Litvisha or a Polish because you need someone who's committed to the idea of Auschwitz. In Lithuania and Poland, they're not committed to this idea of Auschwitz. And also, you need a great Talmud Chacham, because the general community had Dayanim who were big Talmid Chachamim. The last Dayan in the general community, his name was Menachem Mendel Kirschbaum. He wrote the Tshuvos Menachem Meshiv, two volumes. He was killed in the Holocaust. A Gaon Olam. Take a look at his Tshuvos. But of course, these two communities were always fighting. So the Frankfurt community, of course, posseled the Erev of the general community. And so you need a big Talmid Chacham. And Germany didn't produce any big Talmid Chachamim, and you couldn't get from Lithuania or Poland because they're not reliably Austrian. So you had to bring one in from Hungary. The problem is Rabbi Horowitz didn't really speak German, and he was culturally is completely removed from Torim Derech Eretz Jews. So you can read how Yaakov Katz, who was in Frankfurt during this period, he describes the dispute, and he talks about the very first Shabbos they realized when Rabbi Horowitz spoke that it was a mistake, but for the rest of his life they gave him kavod. And when I told the story over to the great grandson, he told me more information about this because he knew it well, and it wasn't a very good shidduch. But we'll talk more about that. And MJ Frankel says secession outbreaks more frequent in Hungary, Mamaroš, and in Germany, sometimes by the Hasidim, sometimes by the Ashkenazi. We will speak about this. What I want to speak about Hungary is about the controversy over Orthodox, Neolog, and status quo. What you're speaking about, MJ Frankel, is something else. You're speaking about when the Hasidim or the anti-Zionists or any group then wanted to separate because they didn't like the rabbi, then they can call themselves Sfardim or call themselves something to create separate communities. But the fundamental dispute, which is happening the exact same time it was happening in Germany, and actually the law was changed in Hungary before it was changed in Germany, that allowed separatism in Hungary, that created the tripartite system in Hungary of Orthodox, Neolog, and status quo. I will tell you that whole story as well Those of you who've been with me in Central Europe, you know all about this because in Budapest, we go in one day, we see the three shuls, the Kaczynski Orthodox, the Rumbach status quo. It was functionally status quo, though technically it was a member of the general community. But so Rumbach status quo, it was sort of like a modern Orthodox synagogue. And then we see the Duhani synagogue, the Neologue synagogue. And God willing, we will
Yeah.
be returning
Brett,
to
by
Central
the
Europe
way,
this summer. We're not going to let Hamas deter us from doing what we do as Jews. We're going to, and the Jews of Europe, believe me, they need the chizukah. So we will go and we'll talk a lot about the whole situation. Now, MJ Franco, as I recall, you're a descendant from the Dor Ravi, correct?
No, that's David Glasner. I
Glaser. Okay.
actually have the other side of that machlokas. I'm a descendant of the Yismach Moshe.
Oh,
So,
okay.
in fact, my remarks are particularly focused on Transylvania, the Marmarish,
Yeah.
and the Satmar guys are all they're all my cousins.
Okay, well, that's there's a lot of yuchas there, and the Yismach Moshe comes from a city, however, which was a status quo city. Uzhali, how do you pronounce it? You had a Godel of Yisrael there who refused to join the
Ashbon.
Orthodox community, the Divrei
Yeah,
Yirmiyah. So we'll get to that. Privately, someone says that one of the factors in not picking Rabbi Raphael Breuer was that he wrote a commentary on Shir HaShirim. He wrote a commentary on Shir HaShirim. He wrote two. He had to do a second one in which he interpreted it literally, but in a kosher sense, that human love is also desirable in the context of marriage. But that became a big dispute. His opponents used that against him. And look, he didn't get the position. Rabbi Horovitz is a greater Talmud Chacham, but Rabbi Breuer had the Yichus. He was obviously German speaking, and he was more culturally in tune with the community. But you can read Yaakov Rosenheim's memoir, and you can read Yitzhak Breuer's memoir. Because Yitzhak Breuer sees this as a great betrayal. But from Rosenheim's perspective, the Breuers are just too extreme. The Breuers, did, when they founded Agudas Yisrael, the Breuers wanted to put in this thing, they call it the Hungarian clause, that would have kept great rabbis out of the Aguda Presidium if they were in communities that allowed separatism and they didn't separate. And not just rabbis, anyone could not be on the presidium. And Rosenheim thought that was too much. Rosenheim even wrote a hesped for Rabbi Marcus Horovitz, the same Rabbi Marcus Horovitz that the Breuer community regarded as basically a chotei umachti atarabim. So Rosenheim thought, and he's called Moreinu, the Agudas Yisrael made him Moreinu. They gave him this title, and he's one of the founders of Agudas Yisrael. But Rabbi Rosenheim thought that the Breuers were just too extreme. He's a great admirer and lover of Hirsch, but he thought that they were too extreme, and it led to a terrible dispute. Finally, Ellie says, I'm very familiar with this set of strange disputes. I lived it. My father was Hungarian, was from Jekesher Utz, the Oberlander, who are the Yekis of the Hungarians. My ancestor on the other side was a Shlach Kadosh. Yeah, I mean, Hungary is interesting. We'll talk about it. And we've spoken about it a great deal before. We've spoken about the Chasam Sofer, the Ksav Sofer who was attacked by the extremists like Rav Hillel Lichtenstein. So we've dealt with all of that. We'll come back to it. But now I think we've spoken enough tonight. I thank you all for coming out. And God willing, we'll see you next week. I hate missing classes, but last week couldn't be helped. Rabbi Kelman is not with us
I'm
because
back. I'm back.
Canadian Jews.
No, I'm
Oh, he's
back.
back.
I'm
Okay,
back
I
from
was going to say he
Ottawa.
went to Ottawa to
Went
do
to
the.
Ottawa today for a rally and in the snow. And we haven't had snow much in Toronto, but they had 20 centimeters yesterday. So standing on Parliament Hill in the snow, but yeah, we had our rally that, and not exactly like the Washington rally. Obviously, we don't have quite the numbers, but anyways, just got back half an hour ago. So
Okay,
that's the
good.
last
You
part
got, let me
there.
tell you something. So far, our president is standing strong. We'll see if it lasts. Our Secretary of State Blinken, maybe not so, but your president, prime minister, has been a disappointment in some recent statements. So I'm happy that you came out and made a strong showing there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, okay, we can talk about it. He has been a little disappointed. Canada doesn't have such a major role on the world stage, or it's decreased a lot, but that's a whole other discussion in recent years. But there are a lot of strong supporters here. But you're right, I mean, obviously it's not Harper anymore. For those who know the Harper years of, it was more pro-Israel than the Israeli government, you know, Harper. But Trudeau's been, he could be worse. Let's say it's not many of the European countries are a lot worse than in Canada. But anyways, but it's good we went and then back from the rally. So,
you know, we're talking about Germany, German history. Germany is strong. It's stronger than America. Germany, Czech Republic, Hungary, but Germany. Whether they're tshuva, they have to do for everything, but the fact of the matter is Germany, they shut down all these pro-Hamas groups that are running wild in our country and in your country. There's no freedom. There's no First Amendment in Germany. So, you know, there's a big, much bigger danger, though. They've taken like a million of the people from the Middle East. And we know by the polls, we know that the majority, if not the overwhelming majority, are terribly anti-Israel, and most of them are anti-Semitic. So Germany has its hands full, you know, if it wants to stop all the hate speech. But we have to give, you know, Hakaras HaTov to what they're doing there now to try to shut this down.
Yeah, lots to talk about. It was nice. I was talking to a Persian, you know, an Iranian dissident. One of them, you know, spoke at the rally. I think they had somebody like that in Washington too, somebody from Iran. She says her family's there. They're all afraid. Most Iranians want the government overthrown, which I don't think is a surprise. I don't know if she knows also exactly, but all her family in Iran, they all want, they all hate the government. But that's the problem. If we could get rid of the Iranian government, I think the world would be a totally different place. But
yes, it will. And the Iranian
Iran
people
is the real problem
people.
Here. Iran is.
But Iranian people are good people. If you had an election,
correct,
things would be different. The
100%.
Truth is, and the Western media doesn't want to acknowledge it, the politicians don't acknowledge it. If you had an election now in the West Bank, Hamas would win.
Of course.
They did a poll.
Of course.
75% of people in the West Bank supported October 7th. It's like 68% in Gaza. Mm. So people have to recognize what we're dealing with here. It's not, it's an intractable situation here because the population as a whole is dead set against Israel.
Although
in
I think
a genocidal
the Arab Israelis
sense.
Are not. The Arab Israelis, I think, are quite supportive of Israel because they know. Anyways, it's a, I don't know if
you know, when they had the
deals,
when they were working on this program to with Omer, to they would have the border swaps. There were some Arab towns that they were going to swap
and
for Jewish things,
go.
And the Arabs
right.
started protesting.
Of course,
they don't want to be in the Palestinian
area.
It's freaking economically, they would drop, you know, like 100%, and also they don't want to live under the Palestinian Authority.
Right.
So
they have more freedom in Israel than they would under any Arab country. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Anyways,
okay,
all right,
all.
What can I say? But thank you. Okay, we'll see you next
okay.
week, please God. And Rabbi Shulman and Rabbi Helfgott are back this week. They were in Israel on solidarity mission. So Rabbi Shulman will be continuing his shiur in Kohelet. He's missed the last couple of weeks. And that's 3 weeks, actually, Washington and 2 weeks in Israel. So that's tomorrow afternoon. And Rabbi Helfgott will be back on Wednesday night. His shiur on Malachim Beit is also in Israel. Simon Peters will be back, Parsha Shear, Siddur, all the regular shearing. So, okay, everybody be well. Have a good week. Hear good news and bring your friends and let's learn some more Torah and let's give chizik to the Jewish people and let's hope that it's Nishma B'Shamayim and we should hear good news. Okay, Laila Tov, everybody. Boker Tov and Israel, David. Okay. Tennis again, I hope.
Tennis, yes.
Okay, good. Good, enjoy. Okay.
After Vatican.
After Vatican, yeah. Okay, very good. Live the top, everybody.